Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and candidates on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Eggman. Today I'll be taking time to speak with New Hampshire businessman and Republican National Committeeman Steve Dupree and Concord State Director Tyler Sweeney. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. Lawmakers are returning after their Thanksgiving break to several unfinished appropriations bills and the threat of a partial government shutdown. Prior to the recess, Democrats had insisted that any deal had to include a provision to protect special counsel Robert Mueller from getting fired before he wraps up his investigation. The demand has not been received well by Republicans. The two parties also remain at odds over the president's request for $5 billion for a border wall with no obvious resolution in sight. These disputes and a handful of others have created very unfavorable conditions for a bipartisan budget deal that doesn't spark much hope for the budget process in the years to come under divided government. At this point, a partial government shutdown is looking more and more likely. A portion of the Trump administration's new $12 billion program designed to help farmers offset the cost of foreign tariffs may actually be going to, quote, city slickers. That's the finding of a new survey by the Environmental Working Group, a nonprofit advocacy organization that is urging lawmakers negotiating the farm bill to impose tougher standards on aid to reduce the number of urban dwellers eligible for farm subsidies. The survey suggests criteria should be tightened to require investors to contribute personal labor in running a farm. The Government Accountability Office chided the Defense Department for not clarifying the criteria used in a program that awards contracts mostly based on the lowest prices. 2 years ago, lawmakers ordered the Pentagon to issue additional regulations for the program. To date, no updated methodology has been released, leaving Pentagon contractors confused about how contracts are awarded. Single-payer Medicare for All does not appear to be likely in the next year. The incoming chairman of key committees are putting out signals that such a push would be premature. Instead, expect to see pushes for lower drug prices, efforts to shore up Obamacare, and other more accessible goals as Democrats take over the majority in the House. It has been reported that President Trump is demanding top advisors to craft a plan to reduce the country's growing budget deficits. But the president has confused his own aides by repeatedly seeking new spending while also ruling out measures needed to address the country's unbalanced budget. Trump's deficit reduction demand came after the White House reported a large increase in the deficit for the previous fiscal year. After that report, the president asked his cabinet secretaries to identify steep cuts in their own agencies. But even as he has demanded deficit reduction, Trump handcuffed his advisors by limiting what measures could be taken and suggesting that some areas, such as the military, would be left unscathed. Up next, New Hampshire businessman and Republican National Committeeman Steve Dupree will join me to discuss the late Senator John McCain's legacy, midterm election results, and what could be in store for the 2020 presidential election cycle. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined in the show by New Hampshire businessman and Republican National Committeeman Steve Dupree. Steve is a New Hampshire Republican National Committeeman. He's a former state rep, ran for Congress in the 90s, and was chair of the New Hampshire Republican Party. He was also a longtime friend of the late Senator John McCain. Thank you for joining the show, Steve.
I'm glad to join you. Happy to do so.
Well, we appreciate you taking the time to be on Facing the Future, and I have a handful of topics I wanted to discuss with you today, but we'll see how far we get depending on the time that we have. Primarily wanted to talk a little bit about The late Senator John McCain from Arizona. I've wanted to talk about him and his legacy on the show for a while now, and think this is the right time to do that on the heels of the midterm and really facing the reality of quite a polarized political climate at the moment. He was considered a maverick in the Senate, someone willing to work across party lines, step on the toes of his own party when necessary. And Steve, you had a strong relationship with him for a number of years. I wonder if you could give us a little bit of insight of how you came to know John McCain and maybe a few anecdotes of the relationship you had over the years.
I think I first met John in 1989 or 90, 91, right in that era. I was helping Phil Gramm raise money for the United States Republican Senate candidates. I went to a dinner in Washington. He was a junior senator, and I was pretty junior fundraiser. So we were both assigned to the same table at one of those long, drawn-out dinners at the back of the hall. And I was immediately impressed with him because he likes to joke and cut wisecracks, and his sense of humor and mine kind of lined up. And we met that evening and just seemed to hit it off. And when he started to think about running in 2005 and 6, he asked me to be on the board of directors of John McCain, Inc. So we worked very closely right through the primary here in New Hampshire, which he won. He came from 20 points down, Labor Day, to Rudy Giuliani, and 10 points down to Mitt Romney. Then he asked me to travel with him, and there are people who keep records of miles traveled and things like that. And other than John himself and Brooke Buchanan, his press aide, I spent more miles with John McCain in 2008 than anyone. And even though we didn't get the result we liked, our friendship endured, and I helped him in his 2010 and 2016 campaigns. So it started off in politics and then just became a real friendship, and it's one of the great honors of my life. He's a hero.
Yeah, I definitely have to agree with you there, Steve. He's a hero in many respects. And I like that you mentioned that you both had a similar sense of humor. You made a lot of jokes together. Are there any jokes that he liked to either give out on the campaign trail or maybe between friends on the campaign bus that really stand out to you?
I kept telling him that he really missed his calling. He should have been Johnny Carson's successor. He loved town hall meetings because it gave him a chance to practice his comedy shtick, which wasn't very good. But people got so used to hearing the same jokes over and over, they'd laugh. He always used to tell a joke. He said, you know, there's a lot of interesting people who've run for president from Arizona. Barry Goldwater ran and lost. Mo Udall ran and lost. I can't remember the governor's name out there. The Democratic governor, he ran and lost. John McCain, he ran in 2000 and lost. Arizona may be the only state in the country where mothers don't tell their babies they could grow up and one day become president of the United States. So that was always one. He always used to say the water was so scarce in Arizona that the dogs chased the trees. Or the trees chased the dogs. Got that one backward. You know, he had this stick that, and of course, in the famous O'Reilly twins joke, which I won't bore you with, but he loved telling Irish jokes. And he liked to laugh. He also had a great sense of the sometimes absurdity of politics. There was, in 2000 when he ran, he said there are two great purposes to this campaign: to talk about important policy issues, and everybody waited, and he said, to have some fun. And he, you know, it was serious business, but that didn't mean you couldn't have some fun. And we tried to have a little fun every day, and that's how he and I hit it off. And there were a lot of days in 2008 that weren't that much fun, particularly after the economy collapsed and it became very much an uphill battle. But he had an irreverent sense of humor. Nothing was sacred. And so we just used to like to joke and laugh on that plane.
Yeah, it sounded like he was a great fit for New Hampshire politics, particularly when he would do all of his town halls. And you mentioned, you know, he always had sort of two priorities while campaigning, one talking about important policy issues and also having fun. We covered the fun bit. What were some of the policy priorities that you recall really standing out for him that he liked to talk about?
Well, I Mike Dennehy doesn't get nearly enough credit for engineering that 2000 upset. He loves to talk about how they came up with the notion of the Straight Talk Express and straight talk. You'll remember John McCain was very strongly in favor of immigration reform. And wow, what a different country we'd have today if that debate were over and we'd followed McCain's plan. A little editorial note. But he also, in addition to talking about immigration, he had been a big proponent of campaign finance reform, which was hardly popular with the rank-and-file Republicans, who he had to convince to vote for him in a primary. So, like, I think well over 50% of Republicans disagreed with his view on campaign finance reform. So they decided that, you know, how do you pivot from people giving you hell saying, I think you're all wrong and all wet on campaign finance reform, to trying to get that same person to vote for you? So he started saying, well, I'd like to give you a little straight talk here, which is usually a signal those of us on the inside know. It means, I know you profoundly disagree with me, but let's get over that and find another issue that you might consider voting for me on. So the Straight Talk Express was a great, Straight Talk was a pivot from, I know you think I'm full of horse manure on this issue, but let's try this issue. But, you know, John, the more I got to know him and watched him in action in Arizona, where he wasn't always popular with some of the rank and file, and in Washington, where he was seldom popular with either side of the aisle with a lot of his colleagues, is that he told you what he thought. And the other thing that was sort of remarkable about him on the policy area, most politicians take a position and then they spend way too much breath and effort defending that position, even when facts and logic would dictate you maybe should take a different tack or rethink the issue. And John McCain was unique in that he was willing to admit when he made a mistake in judgment or fell short of his own expectations of how he should handle something. And, you know, nobody's perfect, but there are a lot of people in the United States Senate who think they're as close to it as you can get. And what was very refreshing about John was he could admit when he had made a mistake or been wrong or sometimes offended somebody. And that human quality made him remarkable and a giant among his colleagues.
Yeah, that seems like a very rare trait these days in politics. This is Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. I'm speaking with New Hampshire businessman and Republican National Committeeman Steve Dupree. Right now, talking about the late Senator McCain's legacy and time in the Senate. And I wanted to piggyback off of something you just said, Steve, and that was McCain's willingness to engage in the straight talk and find issues of commonality that he could discuss and work with either voters or constituents or his colleagues. Do you think that is really his biggest legacy, or do you think there are some other aspects of his character or his policy accomplishments that really should be considered as part of that legacy?
Well, I'm going to start on the international stage. I think one of his biggest legacies is he stood for freedom and the dignity of all human beings around the world, and he wasn't afraid to call out anybody. Frankly, he was more outspoken in calling out Putin than President Obama ever was, and certainly President Trump. He, I think, more correctly, more often diagnosed the world situation than Presidents Bush, Obama, or Trump. And he wasn't afraid to speak out about that. And, you know, Lindsey Graham used to like to kid that whenever there was gunfire in some part of the world, McCain thought it was a great place to vacation. And, you know, the hope he gave to people all around the world who live under oppressive and repressive regimes, standing up for freedom, is impressive. You know, I think second, in a very rare area of bipartisanship that still exists, John McCain passed a military budget for our defense that rethought and reshaped our defense and did it on a bipartisan basis in this last year of his life. And thank goodness there is still one area, at least, where we can drop a lot of the partisanship and find common ground, because obviously there's nothing more fundamental to defending our country than having a defense system that works. So that was a remarkable legislative achievement, which sounds pretty boring, but it's a big deal. And then I think his lasting legacy is that you don't have to attack people's motives if you disagree with them. You can fight like hell on issues the way he and Joe Biden would, or he and Ted Kennedy would. But you never should assume that just because the other person disagrees with you or has a very different viewpoint, that they're a bad person or that their motivations are wrong or bad. And too often, everywhere, even in local politics, the first line of attack is to question the motivation of the other side. And I think John tried to warn his colleagues and the country that that is a road to the death of democracy if that continues. You know, he pointed out you can disagree without being disagreeable, but you should try and find common ground.
Yeah, I think it's increasingly difficult for members of both parties to disagree without being disagreeable. And that brings me to my next question, and that is, do you think there's anyone in the Senate right now that sort of fills that void left by Senator McCain when it comes to the accomplishments you mentioned, as well as his willingness to be candid, straightforward, and not go for just the personal attack, but look for common ground?
No.
I don't know if you can get any more concise than that.
There is no member of the United States Senate. I mean, there are some who have some of those traits. I think Susan Collins is a terrific senator. I've known her since I was 18, 1971. We were in a program together. I think she's a good senator who calls it as she sees it, even if it isn't popular. Obviously, the Kavanaugh nomination was the most recent case. She's a courageous senator, and I give her great marks for that courage. And she works well with a lot of senators trying to find that common ground. But, you know, in the last half century of the 20th century and into this century, I mean, really the two legislative giants were Ted Kennedy and John McCain, sort of outsized personalities who, either because of their history or their record, rightly or wrongly, and that takes nothing away from all the other senators who work really hard, and there are a lot of good people in the Senate, but McCain and Kennedy just commanded outsized attention, and that gave them the ability, more than other senators, to move issues.
What kind of impact do you think that'll have on the Senate in the short term and maybe even the long term over the next decade to two decades?
You know, I'm an optimist in life, but this is not an optimistic time. The way I think Congress functions poorly, I consider being in the United States House of Representatives a thankless job that accomplishes very little unless you stay there so long you have some degree of seniority. The Senate's a little different because it's smaller and has more impact. But even then, I mean, look back at Warren Rudman, who was a very distinguished senator. If you read his biography, he really weighed in on two issues that he's remembered for: Iran-Contra hearings, which are investigations into executive branch overreach, which were important. I'm not sure they've had any lasting impact. And the Graham-Rudman-Hollings Deficit Act, a good part of which is dead and gone. It's very hard to have an impact. The legislative branch has been superseded by both the executive branch, which has grown way too powerful, regardless of who's president, and the judiciary. And I'm not sure I see anybody stepping up in the leadership of either party in the House or the Senate who can turn the tide on that. Even John McCain and Ted Kennedy had a hard time trying to keep the Senate as a deliberative body.
I want to shift gears for a second here. What did you think of the results of the midterm, both on the state and the federal level? We're looking at, in New Hampshire specifically, divided government in terms of Democrats getting the majority in the House and the Senate and Executive Council. We're looking at the federal level, where Democrats have the majority in the House but Republicans in the Senate. What do you see in terms of a political climate or even policy achievements over the next couple of years as we enter sort of a renewed era of divided government?
Well, let's start at the state level. Chris Sununu had a tremendous win. I know the Democrats won the House and the Senate, and some of their leadership say, no, this is just a vote for family leave and stuff like that. But Molly Kelly ran on that same issue and didn't win. I think there'll be lots of areas of common ground and agreement. I'm not sure that the Democratic priority of legalizing marijuana is top in most voters' minds, but I think there'll be lots of areas of agreement. I think the big disagreement is the Democrats historically have been overly optimistic in revenue estimates and spend every dime of it. Republicans, of course, the Democrats say the Republicans are too conservative, but those of us who are around in 2010 when we had an $800 million deficit, and we were thinking of financing, bonding our current operating debt, we'll know that caution pays off well. So I think there'll be lots of areas of agreement. There'll be disagreement over the budget in some areas, but keep in mind it was Governor Sununu who spent more money on the opioid crisis than any Democratic predecessor. Governor Sununu spent more money on mental health system repair than any previous Democratic governor. So I think there'll be some issues. One thing I regret, I mean, when I was in the House, there'd be five or six partisan issues a session. Now there are a couple hundred. Campaigns have become, we're starting to see some of the questioning of motivation and things like that in state campaigns that we never used to see. When you have a state Senate candidate spending $230,000 for a $100 a year seat, that makes you sort of question either their judgment, sanity, or motivation, I guess. So I think the Democrats won because part of it was a reaction, normal midterm reaction. The party in power tends to lose some seats. Certainly President Trump's a lightning rod, motivated Democrats. And frankly, we were out-hustled. The Democratic Party did a much better job fundraising and getting money to those candidates. I also think the Republican Party here in New Hampshire needs to get a younger, more diverse candidate base instead of some of the older folks who serve. And, you know, one of the myths when we passed annual sessions was that we'd have two short sessions each year instead of one six-month session and then a special session in the off-year for 2 months. And it was going to enable more business people to be involved. But the truth is we've become a six-month session 2 years in a row. So the demographic of the House tends to be two-person couples, one person who doesn't need to work outside the home, retired people, and some students. So I think in 2 years, frankly, the Republicans will win the House and Senate back because we'll have a much stronger turnout in the presidential year. Nationally, I think the House is going to jump up and investigate everything under the sun. I'm not sure much positive will come from it, but they'll do battle and try and, much like Republicans in the House did with President Obama, to be frank here, try and bring the Trump administration initiatives to a halt. I think in the Senate you'll see a continuation of what they can do, which is they're going to confirm lots more judges. That's Mitch McConnell's mission. I'm not sure much else will be accomplished beyond that.
Yeah, that makes me a little frustrated when you consider fiscal policy and how broken the budget process has been and how the House is even struggling right now to get the maybe even a continuing resolution passed by December 7th for the remainder of discretionary spending. So I agree. I think we're entering a state at the federal level where we may see some more gridlock, some more brinksmanship when it comes to some of these issues. And we'll see what 2020 has in store. And that's probably my last question for you, Steve. What do you see happening in New Hampshire in 2020? We're the first in the nation primary state. We have a rich tradition here. You mentioned McCain's success and efforts here in the state. Do you see a challenger against President Trump in the Republican primary? Do you see 20 Democratic candidates coming to the state? What's the picture look like for you on the 2020 cycle?
First one, postscript. I'm one of those old-fashioned traditional Republicans that believes we should balance the budget and deal with the debt. The worst thing we're doing in this country, both parties are horrifically guilty of this, is we are bankrupting the future generations, and we're doing it quickly, and it's completely irresponsible, and I'm going to be very outspoken here. I love tax cuts, but I only like tax cuts that are paid for, and I think it is an abdication of what the Republican Party stands for when we do not come up with a plan to reduce the debt responsibly, when we complained about President Obama not doing it. And the only way we're going to reform and start paying down the debt is to reform the entitlements. Warren Buffett doesn't need Social Security. Steve Dupree doesn't. And even though it's not supposed to be a wealth transfer program, you know, my parents' generation and my uncle fought on the shores of Italy against Nazis. He'd never been to Italy, didn't know what a Nazi was, but his country called on him to do that and make that kind of sacrifice. I don't think it's too much to ask the affluent in my party and the other party and all citizens to give something up so that we tackle the debt and deficit. So enough on my soapbox about, but I'm one of those old-fashioned Republicans who believes in balancing the budget.
I don't mind that soapbox. That's fine.
So I do think there will be a challenger to President Trump in the New Hampshire primary, because even going back to Gerald Ford, my second race, or Richard Nixon in 72, there were challenges. Ford had Ronald Reagan as a challenger. And even though at the time I didn't quite appreciate it, it was post-Watergate, we had an appointed president instead of an elected one, I didn't think Ronald Reagan should challenge the president at that time, and I was in the legislature, he was right. It was good for our party, and besides from that, it also made Ford a stronger candidate. So I do think there should be a challenge. Our party will stay neutral. That's the rule. I think it's likely to be either Governor Kasich or Ben Sasse, the senator from Oklahoma or Nebraska. I can't remember which state. Somewhere out there in the middle of the heartland. And, you know, I think it's President Trump has overwhelming support in the Republican Party. I don't think he fares as well with independents. And who knows what the next 2 years look like. I think he certainly is the prohibitive favorite and very likely nominee, barring some disaster. But that doesn't mean there can't be good issues raised in a discussion that may make for interesting times. I think the Democrats take it from the former chairman of the debates committee in the Republican Party. They're going to have 16 or 17 candidates. It's going to be difficult to manage that process. And if I were a betting man, I would say the likely favorites are Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Joe Biden. I mean, think about it. They have name recognition. They have ardent supporters. And when you have a very crowded field, you can win a New Hampshire primary with 22, 23% of the vote or less. So we very well could see a Trump versus Sanders election. And in that race, I think Donald Trump probably wins. He has bound himself to the Republican Party. I know when he first ran, people wondered whether he'd run as a Republican, but he ran his entire campaign last time through and working with the Republican National Committee. They've got an experienced team. They know what they're doing, obviously.
I lied. I have one more question for you, and it pertains to New Hampshire. Is there any danger that New Hampshire loses its first-in-the-nation primary status? What do you think needs to be done to ensure that we maintain it?
Let me tell you what people don't realize. Up until two cycles ago, the national party committees were content to let the states have a free-for-all and duke it out. And I can tell you, just on a number of occasions, Bill Gardner's willingness to go toe-to-toe with, at one point, Governor Shaheen, I think that was the 95-96 cycle, in 2008 to call a primary a lot earlier than we wanted, January 8th, has kept New Hampshire first. The fact, and I can tell you, in defending the primary now over 20 years, sometimes the complaint we get from committeemen from and committeewomen from other states who arguing they should take it away, they say, well, you've got a Democratic Secretary of State. The fact of the matter is he is so nonpartisan that actually helps us. That history of nonpartisanship has helped us. What happened, though, two cycles ago is that both parties have recognized that the Supreme Court has said the parties are private organizations and they can control their own nominating process. What that means is that if either party decided to adopt what we call a death penalty pill or a death pill, they could end the New Hampshire primary. How? You pass a rule that simply says any candidate who puts their name on a ballot in any state that does not follow our schedule as we, our national party, sets forth, shall forfeit not only the delegates earned in that state, but 50 or 75% of all delegates earned nationwide. If a party adopted that rule, no candidate would dare defy it. Because if you defy it and you don't win the nomination, you're toast. That the parties have woken up to that power, and we have for 20 years, first we hope they never figured it out, and now that the parties know they have this power, we've been engaged in a constant effort, lobbying actually, to say, look, we do this better than anyone else. One, they get to meet every voter. Two, the parties are completely neutral. Three, Bill Gardner plays it absolutely straight. He doesn't favor one side or the other or one candidate within one side. Those are all arguments that help. So our party primary is safe this cycle because Donald Trump loves New Hampshire because he won. We already had a special committee that looks at the calendar every 4 years. I was on that. We resolved that almost a year ago. So we're good, and the Democrats are good. 4 years from now, all bets are off, and we have to fight that fight again. People take the primary for granted. They shouldn't. It is a special privilege. I argue it has tremendous value because candidates actually have to talk to voters, which you don't do once the whirlwind picks up and you leave New Hampshire, but they get to know real people, real issues. The press likes it because they can cover it, and we have a long tradition of doing it well. But we have to make that argument every 4 years.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and Steve Dupree discuss the late Senator John McCain's legacy, the midterm election, and what might 2020 hold for us in New Hampshire. Thank you for joining the show, Steve.
Thanks for having me. It was an honor.
Up next, Tyler Sweeney will join me to discuss making national fiscal policy relatable to you. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Concord's State Director, Tyler Sweeney. Tyler is a New Hampshire native. He has lived on Mount Misery most of his life. Thankfully, Tyler is not a miserable person. In fact, he's quite fun and enjoys working with Concord volunteers and leaders around the state. He's also a graduate of New England College, and he's been on Facing the Future before. Welcome back to the show.
Happy I could make it on this snowy, sleety day.
I wanted to have you on the show to talk more about how we can make national fiscal policy more relatable to those who don't do what we do on a daily basis, which is basically eat, sleep, drink, fiscal policy. So I want to kick off the discussion and ask you, Tyler, why you think it's important to give some of the examples we're gonna talk about in the show today in an op-ed or in a presentation or what have you when you're going about your work for Concord.
Well, when I first took the job, I'm 25. My friends are in their 20s, and, you know, they try to avoid everything that is politics and fiscal policy. And the biggest trouble I had at the beginning was not necessarily getting the knowledge. It was explaining to people what I do for a day job. So I'm trying to break it down to a point where even my close friends, who are as apolitical as it gets, can understand basically what it is I'm talking about.
So that being the case, let's jump right into some of these topics. And the first most obvious topic for me is the annual budget deficit and the debt as a whole. I think you have talked about breaking it down into sort of two different categories here, a family budget and then the idea of a credit card. So maybe start with the family budget and how that can be analogous to the federal budget.
Yeah. Before we get into it, I just want to warn anybody like us out there who's going, these are not going to be perfect examples. And I'm going to completely agree they're not. But I worked in construction before this, and I'm a big believer in laying a foundation before you build a house. So when a family is trying to plan for their budgetary expenses for the year, they lay it all out. They've got their rent or mortgage payments. They've got their health care payments. They've got that rainy day fund. And you got your food. And it keeps on going. Every year, Congress is supposed to put together 12 appropriations bills, which lay out the entire discretionary budget of the federal government. And these work in a very similar way to the family budget, where they're trying to anticipate their needs and provide for those future costs.
Gee, wouldn't that be swell if Congress actually did that every year?
Well, let's just pretend that they did. This is a perfect world scenario. So I want to really try to tie those two together, the family budget and the congressional appropriations process. They're supposed to be very similar, where you set priorities and you try to make sure that you end in the black every year.
Yeah, live within your means.
Live within your means, which is something that our government is not the best at. I believe in the past 50 years, there's only been four times where we actually brought in more than we spent. The American family has to work by a different set of rules. That's where the credit card comes in. When you have a credit card, you should use it sparingly. It's access to funds that you do not have normally. Remember, about 2 weeks ago, you helped me tie up my muffler to the bottom of my car. That was not something I planned on doing.
That was fun.
That was fun. But that was an unexpected expense. So, you know, it wasn't planned for in my budget. So I had to use my credit card to pay off the payment for that. I have since paid off that debt. The United States government, we tend to borrow more. And as a result, we're seeing $21 trillion in debt. We have a high interest payment on that debt, kind of like how if you have high credit card debt, you will have a higher monthly payment that you have to pay.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think it's certainly not a perfect analogy, like you mentioned before. Really, none of these analogies will be perfect. But a credit card is a good insight in that it should be used relatively sparingly. You certainly, it's not a bad thing to have that debt, but carrying the cost of that debt can be very expensive, and you should be making budgetary decisions and life decisions with the long-term ramifications of your debt in mind, and I would hope that our federal government would do the same.
Absolutely. If the average family was relying on credit card debt to pay for their everyday expenses, then that could quickly get out of hand with their interest rates. It builds up very quickly to a point of unsustainability, and the American government is doing pretty much the same thing.
You could quickly make the argument that we are using debt to operate our federal government, which is a dangerous place to be. This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Concord's State Director Tyler Sweeney about making fiscal policy a little more relatable, and I want to move from the credit card example, Tyler, to another policy issue that you have focused on, and that is Social Security, specifically as it pertains to the ratio of workers paying into the system for beneficiaries receiving, obviously, benefits in that system. Can you give us maybe an analogy that might be fitting for that?
So last year, my best friend and I went to my first concert. It was a giant road trip. It was great. And we started talking about stage diving. And how we hoped that the lead singer was just going to jump off the stage into the middle of the mosh pit. And, you know, stage diving works if there's a significant group of people to catch you. However, if you start rounding that down, you start going down to 4 people, 3 people, it gets hard. If you get down to 2 people, somebody's probably going to the hospital. About 50 years ago, 5 people were working for every 1 retiree. However, we're at a point now where we're at 3 workers for every 1 person taking out, and soon we'll be at 2 for every 1 taking out. And we've got to start looking at the system and how we can fix it in a way that that person who jumps off the stage has enough hands there to make sure he doesn't hit the ground.
I do agree that reforms need to be made in the system to at least take into account the reality of that changing ratio. And I think your stage diving example is a good one in that I don't know that I'd want to jump off a stage if it went from, 10 people in the crowd that were sitting there with open arms to 2 people. And I think I'd end up smacking my face on the hard floor coming off of the stage. Another example I think is a good one would be the trust fall concept. And it's very similar, I think. That is, imagine yourself standing on a table and you've got, say, 6 people, 3 on each side, ready to catch you. Now imagine that you're down to like 3 people, 2 on one side, 1 on the other, trying to catch you. And you might be a little less confident in whether you're going to get caught. Now imagine just 1 on each side of you. And I want to cover one more example as it pertains to discretionary spending, and that is the part of the budget that Congress plays with every year during the appropriations process. It's about a third of the budget and shrinking. And you had a very apt analogy in what it might be like to buy a new car on a limited budget.
Well, yeah, I am actually in the market. I'm currently driving my grandpa's old Impala, and it is somehow still alive. I'm seeing all these heated seats out there. I love a moonroof, I would love some, and a snappy interior. Black and red leather would be cool.
I like the features where the car practically drives for you.
Yes, yes, I do too. And all of those extra features result in a higher monthly payment. The problem with that larger payment is it leaves less room for me in my discretionary spending, the budget that I put out there for what I can afford, for going out with friends, most importantly for gas that will go into the vehicle I am purchasing.
And I'm assuming that's because a monthly payment for a car would in effect be automatic. You don't have a choice.
Absolutely.
If you want to keep the car, you got to pay for
that's
it.
That's right. They'll come back and they'll take the car if you can't make that payment. But that's kind of in the same token as mandatory spending is to the federal government's budget. So mandatory, as you know, is Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. These payments are automatic. And the nicer they are for the people in them, the higher the payment. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but we need to be cognizant of the fact that this is going to put pressure on the discretionary side of things, which are things like education, transportation, research and development, things that are forward-looking, things that are going to help us down the road.
Yeah, I think those are some great examples. We mentioned the federal budget being similar to a household budget in the sense that when it comes to the discretionary aspect of the budget that Congress is supposed to be prioritizing, just like a household budget would have to do. We discussed how the national debt and deficit is similar to having personal credit card debt and the interest rate that is carried on that and how that needs to be factored into how it might impact your budget and long-term ramifications of the cost of that. We also discussed the trust fall or stage dive for Social Security when it comes to the ratio of beneficiaries to workers in that program. And last but not least, buying a new car and having the monthly payment of that auto loan could be higher with the swankier the car, and it might impact what else you have in your discretionary budget to afford even the gas in the car to get you down the road, and how that's similar to the federal budget in that the larger the mandatory spending items, the likely the less you have available in discretionary spending, which are often the forward-looking, future generation-oriented investments.
Yeah, and I think that these examples are really apt for people my age, millennials, who are coming into a scenario where they have plenty of debt and they have all of these economic hardships themselves. It helps them get into this conversation at the ground floor. It really is the foundational knowledge behind what we do.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and Tyler Sweeney discuss making national fiscal policy more relatable to you. Thanks for joining the show again, Tyler.
Always a pleasure.
We will be back after these short messages for our final segment, Facing the Facts. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and this is our final segment, Facing the Facts, where I share with you a fact or piece of information that I think is worth you pondering until next week's show. In keeping with the theme of the show, working with others and making fiscal policy relatable, I thought it pertinent to introduce you to another of the Concord Coalition's primers. So it's time to face this fact. Fiscal responsibility is important for current and future generations. The federal budget is more than just numbers on a spreadsheet. It reflects our priorities as a nation. The choices we make today or fail to make will determine what kind of future our children and grandchildren inherit. Fiscal responsibility is essential to creating a stronger, more prosperous nation for the future. Unfortunately, policymakers have continuously ducked hard choices about spending and taxes. Such fiscal irresponsibility jeopardizes younger Americans and coming generations. So how does fiscal irresponsibility jeopardize younger Americans and coming generations? Well, for starters, they'll inherit a legacy of debt, and we're investing less in them and jeopardizing their health care and eventual retirement. We're also limiting their own economic future. Year after year, the government has spent more money than it takes in and borrowed the rest. These annual deficits add to the national debt. And to make matters worse, under current laws, these deficits are projected to rise rapidly in the coming decade and beyond, reaching $1 trillion as soon as the upcoming fiscal year and sustaining at that level for years to come. As the debt grows, so does what the federal government must spend just on interest payments. Already, we spend more on interest than several key government agencies combined, and we'll spend more on interest than the defense budget within 5 years. In addition, interest rates are generally expected to rise above their currently low levels, and the Congressional Budget Office projects that within the next decade, interest spending will become the third largest expense in the federal budget. Most Americans say they want the best for their children and grandchildren. If so, we should not leave them the bill for the things we have refused to pay for ourselves, or continue to waste billions of dollars a year on interest instead of investing in their future. Because of the aging U.S. population and rising health care costs, the federal government devotes a large and increasing part of its budget to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. These so-called, quote, mandatory programs do not require annual congressional approval and are essentially on autopilot. Their spending levels are determined largely by the growing number of eligible beneficiaries. Although Congress can alter these mandatory programs, many lawmakers are reluctant to do so in ways that would reduce spending on them and thus anger beneficiaries. A key factor in this reluctance is the reality that older Americans tend to vote more frequently than younger ones. But as we saw in the 2018 midterm, that trend is starting to change. The steady increase in mandatory spending that largely benefits older people is, together with rising federal interest payments, crowding out other parts of the budget that are, frankly, more likely to benefit younger people. And those parts of the budget that would largely benefit younger Americans are considered, quote, discretionary spending, meaning Congress and the president approve them on an annual basis. Most programs that could be considered long-term investments in the country's economy, such as education, transportation, or scientific research, are discretionary. And investing less will make it more difficult to support higher levels of debt in the future. In the 1960s, more than two-thirds of federal spending was considered discretionary. Now less than one-third is. Yet when elected officials talk about federal budget reductions, they are generally focused on further cuts in discretionary spending. These trends could limit policymakers in their ability to respond to changing circumstances, new priorities, or even future needs. Social Security and Medicare are on unsustainable paths, even their trustees say so. Each year, the trustees of Medicare and Social Security warn that these critical programs are at financial risk under current policy. Spending is projected to grow faster than the economy, while funding won't keep pace with the increased spending on benefits. One result of this is that Social Security and Medicare will become more dependent on general federal revenues in the coming years, further squeezing important programs that help young people. The longer we wait to fix the problem, the higher taxes will have to go during younger Americans' working years. Not to mention, most young Americans have lost confidence that these programs will even be there for them when they retire. But these programs can and should be put on a sustainable course. The sooner we enact efforts to reduce their growth and create sustainable funding, the less dramatic the changes will need to be. But time for that is running out, as both programs are projected to soon be insolvent with depleted trust funds. For Social Security, that would mean automatic benefit cuts unless reforms are enacted. Excessive federal debt also hurts younger Americans and future generations by hampering economic growth. As the federal government continues to borrow in large amounts, it leaves less capital that might otherwise be put to use in the private sector. Over time, this can make the U.S. economy less competitive, hold down economic growth, and keep living standards lower than they would otherwise be. Most economists project that even with the recent sugar high in the economy brought on by massive tax cuts, economic growth will flatten at around 2%. And despite constant growth coming out of the Great Recession, there is now growing concern that another recession is on the horizon. Older Americans say they want what is best for their children and grandchildren. But current federal policies do not reflect that. Americans must demand that their elected officials in Washington pursue reforms that can put the federal budget on a more responsible and sustainable trajectory. Without such reforms, our children and subsequent generations will be penalized by lost opportunities, lower living standards, and a less safe and secure place in the world. You have been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.